This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. It was President Lyndon Johnson who declared war on poverty almost 50 years ago. Today, you could make a case that America has lost that war. The poverty rate has continued to rise, and now 46 million Americans in the U.S. live in poverty, the highest number ever recorded.
The long recession is partly to blame, but some argue that the way we've been trying to help people get out of poverty is a big part of the problem. Among them is Maurice Lim Miller. Miller ran social service programs in the San Francisco Bay Area for 20 years before he realized that the traditional approach of handouts and public assistance wasn't working.
He thought of the way his own mother, a poor Mexican immigrant, helped get him out of poverty. And from that came a radical idea. Stop thinking of the poor as just needy. Stop defining them exclusively by their deficits. Instead, empower them to define what they need and give them a way to go after it themselves.
From that fundamental idea came the Family Independence Initiative, a nonprofit now run by Miller. It involves about 300 low-income families in Oakland, San Francisco, and here in Boston. And the results have been impressive. Participants have seen their incomes rise by 20%. Children's school grades have gone up, along with rates of homeownership and savings.
So how does it work? And can it offer a new way to combat poverty in America? Well, joining us now to explore that from KQED in San Francisco is Maurice Lim Miller. He's president and CEO of the Family Independence Initiative. He's also one of this year's recipients of a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. And welcome to Radio Boston, Maurice Lim Miller. Great to have you.
Thank you very much. It's really great to be invited to this.
Well, tell us first, if you could, how the Family Independence Initiative works. Sort of walk us through some of the basic nuts and bolts of the program.
Well, first of all, it's really not a program. We've been called the unprogrammed, the uncharity. Essentially, it is trying to, again, find out how families would help themselves and help one another. And for us, then, for the last 10 years, we've been exploring what families can do for themselves and really just setting up an environment that challenges them. And the challenge is, okay, so if you could do anything you wanted to do and there could be some resources behind you, then what would you do to get your own family out? And could you pay that forward? Could you really help other people, your friends? And because it really is based on how this country built its reputation around entire communities getting out of poverty and building a middle class, whether it's the Irish immigrants off the docks in Boston, Polish getting into meat factories in Chicago. You still see it today. Cambodians in California start owning all the donut shops. But African Americans, after slavery, built entire townships, Black Wall Street in Tulsa, et cetera. And so we have a history where there really wasn't a program. It was really people really taking their own responsibility, taking their own initiative, and helping one another, because it actually did take community. It took that personal initiative, took community. It did take some resources. And what we wanted to do is test whether that could happen in this period in history. And over the last decade, I think we found it if you set up an environment that just challenges them to do that and you provide them some resources, our history kind of comes back to us and works.
All right. So the way this works, if I have this correctly, is you essentially form groups of folks, family groups, essentially, that can sort of help each other, support each other, and track each other's progress and problem solve with each other. They get laptops. They get a stipend, right, to kind of focus on the various goals that they want to choose, but then they're responsible for going after those goals themselves. Do I have it more or less right?
More or less, yeah. It's pretty close. What we wanted to do is we wanted to learn from the families. This was set up with the help of Jerry Brown, who was mayor of Oakland at the time and now governor of California. And we wanted to learn what families could do for themselves, and that we wanted to go the historic model. So we didn't bring groups of families together. We told some families, I'd worked in the community for 20 years, is like, go find your friends. You get about six or eight of your friends together, and we think that we can learn from you. We'll enroll you. We'll give you a computer, and you provide us data every month on what you do to change your own life, because that's what I remember my mother doing. And I watched her month after month. And I wanted to get this from a number of families, but I also knew that the community was important because I wanted to get patterns out of it. So we pay them actually to report to us. If we didn't have a stipend, they probably would not report because it's too much trouble. But the fact is that earning that little bit of extra money, it's only on average about $160 a month. It pays them for their time, and they get to see all the data. And all of that put together somehow has brought us back to how families in this country have always gotten themselves out of poverty.
Mm. So what does this say, and what do you think it says about the last 50 years or so of the so-called war on poverty? Why has it failed?
Well, there's two aspects to it. One is that in many ways our country has gotten into this bipartisan fight. And one section of the country, you know, is saying that these families are lazy, that they're dependent, that, you know, if they really worked hard, that somehow or other they would make it because that's what this country is made of. And my mother worked hard. The families I know worked tremendously hard. And so I knew that was wrong. On the other side, we formed the war on poverty. And on that side, people say, well, look, you know, give them a break. They're victims. There's been all these things that happened to them. But if, quote, we, the professionals, help them or if we come up with programs, then they'll be okay. And the dilemma is that both of those perspectives say the same thing. Hmm. My mother had trouble with both of those perspectives. One, you know, just overtly says that, you know, you're lazy. My mother used to come back and say, they know I'm Mexican. They think I'm lazy. And then the other side, though, is really great people that want to help. But by actually saying that they want to help you sends a message that obviously you must not be able to help yourself. And my mother resented that, too. She just didn't have the resources. She didn't have the kind of connections that I have now that I'm middle income. And so it wasn't an ability thing, and it wasn't that she needed direction from case managers, which are really actually expensive. Mm-hmm. So, you know, both of those messages have been wrong over the last 50 years, and what we need is to really take a completely look at a different look and go back to our history and let people do it themselves, but they do need resources, which is like, you know, we give them to people that are well off. You know,
yeah, and this is a point I want to really make this point clearly, because in doing the reading that I was doing to prepare for this, I was impressed with this point that you make. And that is that when it comes to public assistance, public resources, benefits, this program treats low-income people the same way middle and upper-income families are treated by this society. And that seems like such a key component here. I'd love you to explain that a little bit.
It's a huge component. And, you know, what I knew is that this isn't about, quote, people, quote, in poverty, under the poverty level, and that we have to get them above the poverty level. My mother was working poor. She did clerk jobs and, you know, retail and whatever. People clean our lawns. And so this, you know, the aspect of people wanting to help themselves and building America really came from working class. And we have very little for that class of folks to build our middle class. And so all our resources have been concentrated on the safety net, which is really important because my sister, you know, got in trouble, and when she'd get beat up and in crisis, she needed the safety net. She actually did need welfare. But as soon as she started working, she became ineligible for everything. And so what I learned is that there weren't any benefits, not just for my family. There weren't any resources once you start working and taking initiative until you become well off. And now that I'm middle income, I have a financial planner, and they're trying to help me figure out, okay, so what are the different discounts and different things I can do? And for the well off, we do trust them. We'll give them a refund check or whatever. But there's a middle piece that is everywhere from people that are making just $10,000 to probably $60,000, $80,000. So this isn't just about people that are poor. What we're trying to do is add a system that recognizes initiative and recognizes strength and invests in it the way we do for the well-off.
Hmm. So is there a risk that this program is, I could imagine people listening to what you're saying and saying, so this is a sort of up by your own bootstraps approach, sort of, you know, sink or swim, but it's more than that.
It's much more than that.
Yeah.
It isn't certainly a sink or swim. I think that this isn't just a challenge. I think we need this country to have a middle class, and we're losing it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like if they sink, we're all going to sink. And that's sort of the feeling everybody in this country has. So we're all in this together. The issue is, where do you invest? Do you just invest your resources, your monies, your discounts, your preferred interest rates just on the well-off? Or do you invest in families that are actually working really hard? Maybe their stereotype is not working hard. But, you know, we have 350 families that are samples of communities across the country. And out of those 350 families, they have created 74 jobs for their community. All of these jobs have gone to their teenagers and whatever. It's what you see in kind of these immigrant communities and whatever. Well, our families are representative across every ethnic group. And they produce jobs. They start buying homes. They buy the hair dryers and all the products that our companies need. And so it really would help all, you know, our entire economy if we can make them more productive. But it does take some investment and, you know, it again has to be based on initiative, not just on need, which is the only system that exists in the country right now for them.
Well, listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Do you think the Financial Independence Initiative is the right approach to finally win America's war on poverty? What do you hear from Maurice Lim Miller? And why do you think poverty remains such an intractable problem in America? If you've ever been on public assistance, does this sound like a program that would work for you? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And let me introduce Candace Keshwar. Candace immigrated from Trinidad to Boston in 2002. She came here with a dream of going to college. She's married. She has a daughter who has cerebral palsy, and she's faced big financial struggles. She's participated in the Financial Independence Initiative. And Candace Keshwar, great to have you on Radio Boston. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we've been listening to Maurice Lim Miller. I'd love to get your sort of firsthand take on this program. First of all, before we talk about your experience with the Financial Independence Initiative, tell us about your situation and the situation you found yourself in before you got into the program. We're not calling it a program, before you became involved with FII.
Okay. So basically, I came, as you said, to pursue a dream to go to college. Became pregnant with twins, had babies, and my daughter was later diagnosed with cerebral palsy. And I think for me, before I joined FII, Family Independence Initiative, it was very isolating. Moved to Boston, no family. It was a very isolating experience, and I felt that this was my life, staying home, trying to navigate systems of care for my daughter, and continuously having to fight to get services for her. So it was a very depressing, type of living before I joined.
And so when you joined, and forgive me, I was mislabeling it, and Maurice, my apologies, it's the Family Independence Initiative, not the Financial Independence Initiative. So when you joined the Family Independence Initiative, tell me how it worked. What did you set up to sort of turn your life around?
Well, I think the first thing that happened is that I was with people who were sharing similar struggles and who in some part were able to achieve small successes, but at least they were able to achieve something. So for me, when I joined, I put down 5 goals that I would want to work on. They were to get my driver's license, get a vehicle, get a job, not necessarily in that order, pursue my dream of higher education, and to buy a home. So when I started in that group, I think because of the group, the first 6 months I was able to accomplish at least 4 of those 5 goals.
And why because of the group? Is it because the group encouraged you? They helped solve problems. They gave you support. What was the importance of the group?
So it was all of the above.
All of the above.
Yes, because you tell the group that you want to do something, and there was accountability to the group. If you said you were going to do something, somebody would ask you. So
the next meeting, it was like, hey, well, how's that GED going,
that's
for
right.
example?
That's right.
Yeah, you told us you were going to do that, and have you made good on it?
That's right. And if you didn't, what was the barrier, and how could I be of help?
Yeah.
So I think... and then if you did do something, they were like this cheering squad. You couldn't wait for the next meeting to come and say, I got my license, I got a job.
Yeah.
Because you knew that you were among people who were cheering for you to be successful.
So what did the experience teach you, and sort of give us a quick sketch of the way your life is today?
My life is not far from perfection, to be honest.
That's so great to hear.
Yes, I'm happy. I think what the group gave me that was most important, apart from support and encouragement, was that I now have community. Mm-hmm. I have people from my group that are now my emergency contacts for my kids. We have keys to each other's homes. We are each other's natural supports. And I didn't have that before.
Mm. And working independently?
What do you mean?
Well, presumably you wanted a job, you wanted to get a house, you wanted to have all those things and sort of make your way toward into the American middle class. I mean, do you feel like you're on that road?
I'm on the road.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's as Mr. Miller was saying, we're always one step away, because when you start to become, when you start to make strides in terms of trying to get above that poverty line, services are cut off.
I see.
So, I'm still at a point where we're one step away from an emergency. If an emergency happens, I'm back to, so like I have savings, we're working towards home ownership. But if I have a major emergency, you know, I wouldn't be back to the start, but, you know, it will set me back a bit.
Sure. But you've got this community. You've got this.
I've got my community now. Yeah.
Maurice, Lynn Miller, I'd love you just to chime in here. We've got some calls that I want to go to. But before we do, what do you hear in Candace's story as how does this exemplify what you're after?
I can tell you that we learned a lot from Candace. We learned a lot from her group. And every group and every family is different. And what we learned, though, is that the issue of respecting the families and their friends, that community, as the experts of their own lives, I feel like that's what we contribute. We also connect them to resources. You know, we can take the edge off because they can of the financial stuff. But nobody seems to realize what a big part pride and respect and being respected really plays in people, you know, moving ahead in this country. Certainly that's what my mother wanted. And you know, when we look at Candace and whatever, it's like, yeah, it's in wonderment of all the things that she and the others have done. So for us, we become the people that are learning from the families. And I think if we take that kind of position, this country could make a whole lot of progress.
Listeners, we're talking to Maurice Lynn Miller and Candace Keshwar about the Family Independence Initiative. Part of it is happening right here in Boston. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. Let's go to Dana, who's calling from Sandwich. Hi, Dana. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I'd like to preface my remark by saying, tell the bootstrap rhetoric to the corporations on the public dole who complain about big government. But my main point is that this family initiative, independence initiative, sounds good, but it should only serve as an adjunct. It should not displace public assistance at all.
And then that's your concern, that it might displace public assistance? Maurice Lynn Miller, respond to Dana's concern there.
Well, I mean, I think he's right. You know, my sister would get beat up. She needed public assistance. She needed the safety net. Mm-hmm. The dilemma is that when there was only that system, as soon as she took initiative, you know, she would end up going back to her husband and getting beat up again because there were no other resources, just the safety net. So people sometimes take our initiative as saying that we're attacking the safety net. It's like that's far from true. We need that. But if we're ever really going to rebuild this country, we need to have an additional system. And the additional system really has to provide resources based on your initiative. That's what we do for the well-off.
Jane is calling from Newton. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm very concerned about these issues, and mainly because I, many years ago, because of a broken marriage, was forced into dire poverty. Got connected to many services. Actually, the one thing and this is something that the public that probably is not aware of, the only thing that I applied for when my husband walked out and left me with five children was MassHealth. I went to an agency. Having brought a child for services at one of our insurance companies, one of our HMOs, that we were no longer covered. So someone suggested that I go immediately to MassHealth, which was in my town. I mean, there was a welfare office there. And I said, okay, fine. I took the children right away to that office, signed up, and gave them my husband's Social Security number because that was part of the, quote, deal. Well, very soon thereafter, I started receiving checks. I thought it was a mistake. I called the IRS thinking it was a rebate, and it turned out that they said, no, that's not one of our checks, after I described the check, the face of the check. They said, no, that's a welfare check. And I said, welfare? And I cried. I said, what do you mean, welfare? I never applied for any that type of thing. I would never do that. And I just there it was, you know, $800 with five children. I mean, thank you. Well, it turned out to be quite a dependency. Not only was the insurance covered, the health insurance, but I was able to provide clothing and food for the children. Stamps came after that, which I never applied for, but they sent to me anyway. It was just one of those things where I just got deeper and deeper involved in the government processes, and I wound up being a complete dependent. And now I'm a senior citizen, still completely dependent on the system.
So, Jane, what you hear us talking about here and what Maurice Lynn Miller's describing, does it sound like an approach that might have been preferable, an avenue that...
Oh, my Lord. Yes. I mean, I always wondered how... I did go to work at one point in time. I joined an agency, and I trained for computer science, and I wound up... By the way, I wound up graduating from university as well, so I do have a degree. It's been very, very difficult. I went to work for just part-time, and when I went to work, immediately on the other end, everything, all the expenses rose because I had received a Section 8.
Sure. Jane, I'm going to, just only because our time is very limited, I'm going to move on, but I'm really grateful for your call, and I hear the case you're making. Maurice Lynn Miller, I'd like to come back to you and ask you sort of where you're headed next with the Family Independence Initiative. I understand it's operating in three cities right now, about 300 families. How big can you scale this up and sort of still keep the integrity of what you're after?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The way we're set up right now is to demonstrate that the families have capacity and that we really should provide resources based on initiative, not just need. And we feel like we still need to demonstrate it, you know, very deeply that what we want to go is very deep in Boston, very deep in Oakland, maybe very deep in New Orleans, a few places where we can actually see demographic changes because, again, there's so much skepticism that families could do it on their own. So we want to do that. But if we were to just run this as the, quote, the program piece, the way we run it right now to demonstrate, we'd only get to the thousands of families. What we want to happen is to have this go to millions of families. And the way it goes to millions of families is the way the resources are made available to, again, the well-off, me as kind of upper middle class at this point in time, which is that, you know, there's a set of benefits that are there when and if we need them, and that it really is based on a vetting system. So now, you know, it really, the vetting for the upper income is that they're rich, that they have assets, that they have connections to the president of the bank, et cetera, et cetera. And so what we're trying to do is say, okay, well, our families aren't rich. They don't have that, but they can show they work very hard. And so what we're doing is actually we've been experimenting over the last 10 years with a series of benefits from scholarships to awards to matching funds for financial loans, and that these kinds of benefits can be made available to low-income families. We call this the opportunity platform. Mm-hmm. And if we start building this set of resources so that families that are working hard and can show that they're working hard, and Candace, you know, with the data that we have on her, it's just amazing. Then if those resources are available, people can build their life over the longer term, just as I can now that I'm more middle income.
Sure. And Candace Keshwar, last word to you. We literally have 10 seconds left. I'd like to know sort of where you see yourself going. What's the goal? Where are you going to be a year from now?
In my own home and with a nonprofit organization to help working families like myself with childcare.
Well, what a great goal. Candace Keshwar, we wish you all the best luck in the world. Thanks
Thank
for coming
so
in.
Much.
We appreciate it. And Maurice Lynn Miller, President and CEO of the Family Independence Initiative, thank you for joining us today from San Francisco. We're very grateful.
Thank you so much.
And listeners, the conversation continues at RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, Tip O'Neill III tells us about bipartisanship in the days of his father and Ronald Reagan. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.